Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, depending on where you are. This is a real treat today. We are meeting an author new to us, Michelle Gagnon, and an author not new to us, we very much admire, Naomi Hirahara. And I'm holding up Naomi Hirahara's August, is it August? I think it's August. Yep. Her August book, her last book, Clark and Division, was a huge success, won the Mary Higgins Clark Award and was nominated Best Mystery and Thriller and was extremely popular here at the Poison Pen. So I haven't had time to dive into Evergreen, but I see we're in Los Angeles in 1946. So you're still exploring past history, right?
Most definitely.
Grant. So Michelle, I have to tell you her biography sort of, I love this. A former modern dancer, dog walker, bartender, freelance journalist, personal trainer, and model. So now we can add author to this, right? And yeah. You're pursuing a master's degree in clinical psychology. And like me, you have way too many dogs.
Oh, way too many dogs.
So how many books have you written? Is this your first adult thriller or am I just getting late to the game?
No, I actually have, I think this is my 10th. I did 4 adult thrillers and then I did 5 young adult thrillers. And now I dove back into the adult waters again during the pandemic.
If I'd actually looked inside the book, other than just reading the story, I would have seen that your earlier thrillers are Kidnap and Ransom, The Gatekeeper, Boneyard, and The Tunnels. What prompted you to try young adult if you'd already written some adult thrillers? Was it a different kind of a writing challenge?
That was part of it. And part of it was just that the idea that I had for a main character was younger than the ones I'd worked with previously. I'd actually had teenagers in earlier books in those first 4. And one of the things that my agent pointed out was that I really kind of seemed to enjoy writing those characters quite a bit. And so she thought I should try and give young adult a shot. And so I did.
By the way, I forgot to mention that we have autographed copies of, that's a really interesting cover too. Cool. I mean, very bold, very designed. I love the blue, which is electric. Anyway, we have copies in the store should you be wanting to read one. And Naomi is going to be actually interviewing Michelle, but I did want to add a personal note here, which I find hilarious because I actually used to commute through Johnson City, Tennessee, between Bristol and Knoxville, where I was earning a Master of Library Science. And Johnson City, I remember because it had one of the great barbecue places in the entire world, just east of Johnson City. The Richwood Barbecue, where people still go to bring back barbecue sauce. And it also had a great restaurant in an old church that had a pressed tin ceiling. And you had to wait for hours to get into it. But I'm sure, because that was back in the late 70s, I'm sure I would not currently recognize Johnson City. So have you been there? Why did you pick Johnson City?
I haven't. You know, honestly, this was all, I started this book during the pandemic, so none of us were traveling anywhere. And I genuinely, someone asked me this the other day, I wish I could remember why. I feel like I might have basically just kind of put a bullseye on a map. I needed a college town that was specific. And I wanted somewhere where to get there to Las Vegas from there would be a bit of a trek.
It is a bit of a trek, but it's actually on, I'm trying to remember, I think you come down, is it 70 or 90 into Knoxville, and then you immediately go west on 40. And, you know, at some point you can hook up to Vegas because 40 goes through northern Arizona. So I'm assuming that's how you'd go. But that was harder to do when I lived there. But, you know, I'm seeing interstates. I mean, it's a long way to go, but it's not that hard to drive.
Right. But if you're trying to leave your life behind and get new identity papers, it felt like that would be the natural first stop that you would make.
Great. Well, anyway, Johnson City caught my attention because I haven't thought about Johnson City or East Tennessee State University, which I think is a pretty decent campus there in a while. So Naomi, why don't you carry on? And if there's anything I have to ask, I'll just interrupt.
Well, Barbara, you got us all hungry for barbecue.
Exactly.
Why did you do that? Now I'm all I'm thinking is barbecue.
It is still the best barbecue sauce I have ever had. I mean, I don't remember, to be honest, if it was pork or whether it was beef. The secret was the sauce.
Awesome. So this is so exciting. I've actually known Michelle since the 2000s, right? Yeah, when definitely. Both of us started writing. So it's just wonderful to be with Michelle. And I love this book. I blurbed it. Hilarious. So I am scared to actually give the elevator pitch because I know I'm going to go in the wrong direction. So I want Michelle, why don't you give us the pitch? And the tone is hilarious. It's a dark comedy. Which is a little different, and we're going to talk about voice. Yeah. So can you give us a little sample of the writing so we get a handle of what kind of book this is?
Do you want me to give the elevator pitch or a little yes. bit of reading? Okay, so the tagline on the front of the book, which I actually love, was she escaped a serial killer, then things got weird. And I just absolutely love that tagline. I think it really does a good job of sort of conveying the tongue-in-cheek, somewhat campy, heightened reality world that the book lives in. Basically, it kicks off with a young woman in the back of a serial killer's van, convinced she's being driven to her death and being very annoyed by that fact because her inner monologue is, I'm not this stupid. How could this possibly happen to someone like me? And then she gets saved at the 11th hour by a mysterious woman who also seems kind of annoyed and just takes off. Unfortunately, the kidnapping brings to light some things from this young woman's past that she has to flee from. So she gets on the road from Johnson City and goes to Vegas to try and score some new identity papers. And somehow ends up in the crosshairs of yet another serial killer on her way there. So it's, you know, kind of like it's our world, but definitely a heightened version of our world.
And can you give us some sample paragraphs or a couple pages?
I can. I'll start at the beginning. The worst part was that I felt stupid. Well, that's not entirely true. The real worst part was that I was tied up in the back of a van with a hood over my head. And based on recent news reports, something truly horrific was about to happen. The feeling stupid was definitely second worst. I'd followed every campus safety alert and obsessively read every news article. Johnson City, Tennessee wasn't the kind of place where anything of significance ever happens. And then, whammo, it was the hunting grounds for a serial killer. The population of 66,000 seemed to have doubled overnight. Satellite news vans lined Main Street. The Holiday Inn was fully booked. And the Johnson City Tribune finally had articles that didn't involve the school board or city council. The killings were all anyone was talking about. And like me, the victims were all petite brunettes in their early 20s. Calm down, I told myself. There was an FBI task force dedicated to the case. The Tribune claimed they'd basically taken over the local police department. An intrepid agent was probably already on my trail. They'd surely find a critical clue just in time to save me. Except there were no clues. We hadn't scuffled, and I hadn't even dropped anything. Stupid, I chastised myself again. The bastard hadn't even done anything clever to trick me. Just past dusk, I was walking back to my crappy apartment in the University Edge complex, mulling over the meager contents of my fridge, wondering if putting strawberry jelly on leftover rice could qualify as dinner. Consequently, I barely registered the white van pulling to the curb 50 feet ahead. A guy in a delivery uniform got out and lumbered around to the side panel, completely ignoring me. I actually did consider crossing the street, but when he grabbed a vase of flowers from inside and turned toward the house, I just figured I was being paranoid. So I continued toward him. Then he literally butted me into the van. For a second, I thought it was an accident. I was opening my mouth to chew him out when the panel door slid shut and he was on me. I struggled, but within seconds, he'd slapped a piece of duct tape across my mouth and jabbed me in the neck with a needle. And when I came to, I was bound up. If it hadn't been so terrifying, it would have been downright comical. Imagine a surveillance video of me getting catapulted into a van by a guy's ass. If serial killers put out blooper reels, that would be on it. I was about to chuckle when my brain helpfully reminded me, you're going to die.
What's going to happen to Amber? So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that Barbara had said that you were new to her, because girl, You've been away for like 6 years. I think Unearthly Things, which was YA, right, was back in 2017. Before that, you've done more like traditional kind of thrillers. So what you been up to, Michelle, since 2017?
I mean, I got some real bad writer's block. I really did. I just hit this point where, I mean, I think I was churning out a book a year almost every year for nearly a decade. And something in me just kind of tapped out. And so I'm not one of those people, like there's some, you know, we know people who are like idea machines, right? There's authors who literally like have 50 ideas coming a minute or 50 a day. And I'm lucky to get one a year. So I had a couple of years where nothing was coming and I was starting to really despair. And then I decided to go back to graduate school because the one thing that I had really been enjoying was the work that I was doing with the foster care system here as an advocate. And working with the kids was really amazing. And a lot of the time they would come to me with much deeper problems. I mean, I just didn't have the toolbox to help them with some of the psychological trauma they were trying to process. So I figured I'd go back to school and get better at that. And so that's pretty much what I've done. And of course, as soon as I did that, I suddenly had an idea. And so I sat down and started writing it. And this was basically my escape hatch during the pandemic. Yeah, that was my custom built, like, let me go somewhere where we're not all wearing masks and bathing in hand sanitizer.
So yeah, the voice, because I know you, you're a funny person, but I don't know if that really has been reflected in all of your writings. So how did the voice, immediately come to you, or was it the concept? How was this book conceived?
Yeah, it really was the voice. I mean, it's funny that this book went through the mill. The final version of this book is so dramatically different from all of the huge iterations. And I have one of the best agents, I think, in the business, who always gives me the most thorough editorial notes. And I will always send her the book thinking like, oh my God, she's going to love this. It's perfect. And then she'll send it back with like five pages of notes, like, and she does that over and over until I want to strangle her, but it makes it always a much, much better book in the end. But the one thing that did not change through every version of this book was that first 20 pages with Amber's voice. Amber's voice was just so clear to me from the get-go. And I don't really, you know, I don't outline. I never know how a book's going to end. This book probably had, I probably had like killed off characters and brought them back to life. I mean, I had so many different versions of an ending for this book, but that beginning never changed.
No, besides Amber, this is chock full of female characters, right? So besides Amber, what other characters, immediately came to the page?
Grace was pretty clear. So Grace is the woman who rescues her and is, in a way, they're sort of the antithesis of each other. But I actually always felt like deep down, there were a lot of similarities where they were both women who came from really damaging childhoods, who had, you know, were living kind of, you know, I don't want to say abnormal, but who had, you know, resorted to very different lives from what most people have. And I think it was really important. I mean, I started the Me Too movement was a big origin for this book because I wanted a book where there were a lot of women who were relying on what are usually seen as like feminine strengths, like their ability to form relationships. You know, it's not like they have these crazy martial arts skills, like they're smart, they can strategize, they can plan, and they have these networks of relationships that they can build upon. And that's really the strength. So the only men in the book are the killer and kind of a hapless nephew who's there for comedic effect.
Dot was one of my favorites. She works at this Las Vegas hotel. I am a Vegas person. My dad loved to gamble. I mean, he was a smart gambler, but he was all about the old, not the strip, but kind of the Las Vegas you write about. You know, Golden Nugget was like the high tone, high level casino that he visited. So why, tell us more about Vegas. Does that have a soft spot for you? Or did you do, I don't know if you're able to do any research during the pandemic.
I mean, I wasn't during the pandemic, and I'm not, I would not say I'm a huge Vegas person. I'm not a gambler myself is the irony here. But what I love about Vegas is it's such a weird, like it really is kind of an only in America thing, right? Because you always hear the sort of glitzy side in movies like Ocean's 11, which I love. But I also find the seedier side much more fascinating. You know, I mean, I love like the motels, the budget buffets, the pawn shops. Like I love that you can go one block off of the strip and it's like you stepped into a completely different world. And I just find that fascinating. Like I love you can go to a place where like there's a pyramid next to the Eiffel Tower. It's so weird, but so cool. And so yeah, I mean, I just, a lot of it for me was, I really wanted to kind of have fun. You know, I really wanted this book to be fun. I wanted it to be funny. I wanted it to be larger than life. And Vegas felt like the perfect place to set that kind of story.
So were you kind of Googling these places or?
Oh yeah, no, I live on Google Maps. Like then when you drag that little character and drop him off at all.
Okay, I have a few, before I ask you more questions, I have some rapid fire questions for you.
Oh, no.
Okay. No, they're not scary. They're all kind of related to the book.
Okay.
So Pokemon Go or Super Mario Brothers?
Oh, Pokemon Go, hands down.
Yeah. I know. I think, have you ever played that?
Oh, God. Yeah, that was, I mean, I feel like that was it right before the pandemic when that kind of exploded? But no, I mean, I got scarily into that game.
Well, there's like a Pikachu mask, so that's
yes,
why.
Exactly.
Which the Pikachu yeah, killer. I have a 13-year-old nephew, so I'm very close to Pokemon. I feel very cool that I have these cards and I know some of the characters. Okay, you said you don't gamble, but slot machines or video poker?
Slot machines, definitely. Really?
And what kind? The old fashioned?
I like the old fashioned. It feels like cheating if you push a button. And I like the cheap ones. I want the ones you dump quarters into.
Well, that's another good reason to be in the old Las Vegas, right? You could have nickel slots. I don't know.
Exactly.
They might even have penny slots still. I'm not sure. Okay, fight or flee?
I mean, I'd like to say flight, but I mean, flee, but I'm fight. I'd like to say fight, but I'm probably running. Honestly, like knowing myself, I'm out of there.
So in terms of Amber, I mean, how close is Amber to you?
I feel like her voice is pretty close to my voice. Like I feel like her inner monologue and that kind of like appreciation for the absurd and snark, I feel like that's actually very much me. I feel like her voice is probably closest to my voice of anyone I've ever written, even though she's much younger than me.
But you know, we've always been younger, right?
Right.
So yeah, that's because one of my mysteries, the Maserai mysteries, is an older man. And I remember one of our friends asking, Naomi, how can you write about an age that you haven't been yet? So yeah. I think we could always write younger. Yeah. And so was it hard to do the action scenes in this book?
It was a little hard. I mean, mainly because I feel like in characters in the past, I did give them a lot of kind of fighting skills, or they were really good with guns or whatever. And Amber is definitely none of that. You know, her thing is that she was a grifter. So she's really good at kind of talking her way out of situations. So that was hard because it was a little bit limiting. But I also felt like, you know, the way that she does get out is, you know, she's smart and she's kind of planned ahead. So I think that's where a lot of the twists come in, is that she does these very elaborate setups, you know, like maybe even too elaborate sometimes, because she sort of falls in love with the Han, even though she would never admit to it.
Got it. Train, planes, or automobile?
Trains. Trains. I love trains.
Really?
I love a good train. I wish we had a better train system here in the States. I think it's tragic. You know, I watched Murder on the Orient Express and I just have so much train envy. I think it would be fantastic. I can't believe we still haven't gotten a high-speed rail. Like I was like really looking forward to being able to go San Francisco to Los Angeles in, you know.
In an hour, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they are building one to Vegas now. From LA.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
That's going to be crazy. That's going to be great. Nuts.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. Yeah. The Amtrak you know, forgive me, but it's, yeah, not the best at times.
Not the same.
Yeah. And I've traveled a lot. You know, I lived a year in Japan and.
Oh my gosh, that train system is amazing.
Right? Yeah.
Like they get annoyed if the train is 30 seconds late.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
Yeah, but let me add, I've been in Japan a lot, and it isn't just the speed of the trains, it's the incredible organization. When you have your ticket, they actually direct you to a particular spot on the platform, because to make it work, you know, the doors have to open and close like that. So everybody has to be lined up on the platform so that they have an immediate entry. I mean, it's fascinating. Sometimes you have to go in a day or two ahead of time to get your ticket, you know, to, it's a very complex system.
Yeah.
I think the Japanese trains are so nice. Extremely well. I've done trains in Canada. I've done trains. The Swiss have a fabulous train system, which is a lot more casual. And I agree with you. I think it's just tragic that we don't have a decent train service here.
Okay. And the last rapid fire, pizza or donut?
Oh, pizza. I'm not a sweets person. I'm much more savory. Yeah. Don't have a big sweet tooth.
And you have both in the book. What kind of pizza for you? What's your fave?
You know, we actually make pizza. We're big like home pizza makers. So we have like our own little, like we put like burrata and artichoke hearts and sun-dried tomatoes and chicken on it. And that's kind of my jam.
So the dough, do you get it at Trader Joe's or you make it yourself?
We are not that good. We get it at Trader Joe's.
Which is fine. At
Trader Joe's. When I say make the pizza, we roll out the dough and put things on it.
Let's talk a little bit about your writing process, because I know people always ask that question. I mean, has it changed from when you last wrote a book? I mean, and you're also balancing, you're getting your master's. Are you going to graduate soon with your master's?
I am graduating in the fall. In the fall. I have one quarter left. I'm halfway through this current quarter, and then I've got the summer quarter left after that, and then I am done. And I am such a second semester senior at this point. I'm really kind of over it, because what I hadn't fully factored in when I went back to graduate school is that when you're getting a clinical psychology degree, the second year of your program, you're going to school full time, and then you're also working 16 to 20 hours a week as a therapist. And so I was doing both of those things and then trying to edit this book and write the sequel. And what I realized was, you know, I write 5 to 10 pages a day. I do it in 1 or 2 hours. And so I was always like, well, I mean, I can always find an hour or two in the day. But what I realized was that the part of my brain that's usually working on the book when I'm doing other things was now occupied by school and work, because I would sit down to write and there would just be nothing. And that's never happened to me before. So it was a struggle. Like, I have to say that being back on deadline too was challenging. Like, I'm not used to being, you know, I had all these years where I'd be like, I don't have to write today. I'll take today off, you know, because there was no one looking over my shoulder. And now being committed to a summer release date for next year, I was like, oh my God, I have to write a book.
Well, besides, you know, before you got your contract, what motivated you to even do this? Like, from a timing standpoint, it's not the best, right?
No, it was not the best. It really wasn't. I mean, my original plan was that the book would be done and sold, but then my agent kept sending it back to me. So I think I literally got the book sold like 2 or 3 weeks into starting school. And I have had moments throughout where I've, you know, wanted to just sort of throw in the towel and say, okay, well, I'm going to just take a sabbatical from school for a semester, or I'm going to, you know, stop and do my clinical training after. But I don't know, I'm so close now. And I feel like, you know, I have kind of figured out a way to make it work. And I really am excited to be able to do both. I'm doing my clinical training at a center for homeless youth right now, and I just love it. I think these kids are amazing. I'm having such a good experience working with them. So I really wouldn't trade it. You know, it's just funny because it was so many months during the pandemic where there was kind of nothing to do, right? It was just like making bread and binge watching TV shows. And now it's just everything all at once. But there's something kind of great about that.
So how has like working, like you worked with foster youth before and now, you know, working with homeless youth, has that informed you in the way you develop your characters, or do you think it's deepened the way you create your characters at all?
I think it's helped a lot work when I'm writing a character like Amber, who lives kind of, who kind of exists on the fringes of society, you know, and who's in this world that most of us never really encounter. Because I think that, I mean, that's the thing that's always so impressive about these kids is they navigate a very different reality than we do. And they really do have to kind of, you know, scramble to get through it and to make stuff work. And yet they become very adept at it. And I think that's part of what's so interesting to me is I definitely think that it's helped inform that in the writing.
And how about vice versa? Do you think writing these kind of books, I mean, does it help you in terms of your therapy in any way or tackling, I don't know, your studies?
I mean, one of the things I wrote in the author's note, which I think is very true, is that I think that authors, therapists, and con artists actually have like a lot in common because I think that we're all good at reading people. I think that to be able to write people, you have to be able to know how they think. You have to be able to, you know, have a level of empathy for them. And that's what makes it possible because you can really put yourself in someone else's head, right? And all three of those professions kind of require that. And so when I was coming up with Amber, I'm like, well, if you were a grifter and you were trying to go straight, what would you do? And she's like, I'm going to become a psychologist. So she is sort of living, you know, a weird mirror version of my life.
Yeah. And for myself, being a former journalist, just like collecting stories from other people. And I think that's really helped me. And I mean, everybody, some people write so internally. I mean, I'm sure all of these characters, right, have a little bit of Michelle in them. But I think it does help to get more contact with outside people, right? Because there's other ways of looking at the world that maybe are new to us, you know, and so I bet that really helps. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. No, and I mean, a lot of my clients now, you know, I've got, you know, homeless kids, I've got people who are having troubles with addiction, which is something that one of the characters in the book really struggles with. You know, one of the characters is a sex worker. And that's something that, you know, I've also worked with clients who are doing sex work, either black market or gray market. So it's, I mean, I think it has provided a window for me into the lives of people that I might not, you know, usually hang around with. And I think that's also helped.
Well, what do you think about writing? I mean, these are people with, you know, serious issues, right?
Yeah.
And your book kind of, you have a serial killer, you have, you know, hijinks. I mean, do you ever wrestle with that? Like, are you really giving respect to, you know, these folks and what they're going through? Does that ever go through your head?
Because I think that what I've really discovered is even people who I work with who are, you know, who I feel like their lives are pretty grim. There's a lot of humor, you know, because it's a coping mechanism. It's survival, right? Like, I mean, I think the ones I really worry about are the ones who can't laugh, you know, the ones who are just really weighed down. But it's one of the reasons I like working with kids because for kids, you know, teens and early 20s, like they still think like their whole life could turn around tomorrow because it could, right? They kind of don't have that weight on them yet. And I think that that's one of the things in the book is that all of the characters, you know, they're not all in their early 20s, but they all have that outlook, right? Like that they're, and I think Dot actually is the perfect example. I mean, Dot, you know, from the outside, you would not think she has the perfect life, but if you asked her, I think she loves her life. She runs a motel. She's sort of the unofficial queen of Las Vegas, right? Mm-hmm. She's obsessed with noir and has this like fabulous wardrobe and a great partner. And she's, you know, running this citizen sleuth group that tries to solve cold cases.
That's right.
She loves her life. She's, you know, the fatal femmes, right? She's got her crew.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing is that, you know, every one of these characters, I think, does not you know, they're not sad. They're not upset. Like they've kind of chosen where they are by and large.
When I was reading it, it reminded me, and Barbara, I don't know if you've watched the show, Netflix show, Dead to Me.
No, I haven't.
And that Christina Applegate is in that. And it's a hoot. And, you know, it's really about sisterhood.
Yeah.
Right. And like unlikely people, two women who don't seem like they could be friends, you know, kind of join forces. And I kind of saw some of that, you know, in your work. Any kind of either movies or books that you think are kind of similar in tone with Killing Me?
I mean, I don't know if you've watched Poker Face yet, but I absolutely adore that show. And I think that's tonally really, really close to the book. I think that it is very much like that kind of, you know, Charlie is in Poker Face is very much like she and Amber would be good friends. You know, they would get each other. Like, I think they're both very similar in, you know, who they are, how they live their lives, the way they look at the world and their kind of, you know, survival instincts, up for everything, anything. As soon as I saw that, I'm like, okay, that's my character. And I love Hacks, you know, again, like Hacks set in Vegas, great show. And again, like unlikely friendship. So I just love that. And I feel like we don't really get enough of those kind of female buddy movies and female friendships. Not the way that we do with, you know, with the men. Like, I feel like the male buddy movie is like a trope, and the women's, we get Thelma and Louise driving off a cliff, right?
But you know what, guys, there's a wave of them that has emerged in the last 3 or 4 months. There are some that are kind of powered by female rage. Ren DeStefano's book, I'll Kill You, for example, is about identical triplet sisters. And they have that terrific sister bond, but two of them are serial killers and one of them is the cleanup. And very much like that. And there's a book coming out that is very much in tone like your book by Eliza Jane Frazier. She's in your publishing house. And called Girls and Their Horses. I'm going to be talking to her, I think it's next week. But there's some very similar kinds of female, you know, buddy things, sort of, you know, like Spencer Hawk used to be. But, you know, now we're going in a female direction. But what I'm really seeing is a lot of female empowerment. And, you know, Naomi, you've done this as long as I have. So you will remember the 90s when we had that huge woman sleuth surge. Do you remember? I mean, it was Marsha Muller and Sue Grafton and Sarah Perez. Several years in the 90s, everything was about female investigators, mostly private eyes, sometimes cops. And, you know, they always had to have someone who was actually a cop involved in it because they didn't have the power of arrest. And then that all kind of, as it always happens in publishing, that whole thing kind of, you know, faded down. It's like waves come up and down. And now I'm seeing it come back again. And I'm really, you know, I have noticed it. I could probably give you 10 books that were authors I've talked to in the last, since February. That would be very similar to you know, not just like your book. I don't mean that, because yours is the original. Similar. And they're not all humorous. You know, they are not all, I mean, you have to love a woman who, you know, when she's bound up in the back of a truck and she's being painted blue and there's a guy with a Pikachu mask and somebody breaks in and she says, you know, instead of saying save me or anything, she says, who the hell are you? You know, which I think says a lot for her general attitude. But I'm really interested to see, you know, that we're even getting female serial killers, which is that's not the history of the serial killer genre at all. It's almost always been men, and it's usually been psychopaths of one sort or another, you know. But the female killers that I'm seeing right now are driven by rage. They're very targeted, they're very analytic, you know, they're organized rather than disorganized. And I'm not sure that doesn't make them easier to catch. I've thought about that. Because if you have a really disorganized serial killer, it's just going to be luck that one day you can get them. But if you have an organized one, sooner or later, the pattern is going to give them away.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And Barbara, that's why I personally think there are just as many female serial killers in real life. They don't get caught.
There may be, but I'm not sure that women are so much serial killers. But I think there are a great many women who are killers who have never been caught for one reason or another. I mean, it's harder to do it now that poison, you know, that it I think up until forensics got to the point where poisons could be identified and so forth. There were a lot of women who, you know, did either mercy killings or help. Right. I want to get out of this, you know, marriage killings or whatever it might be. It's harder to do that now. But I mean, it's one reason Agatha Christie used poisons so heavily. Alice Peters, in her fabulous historicals, you know, Brother Cadfael was very big, but both of them actually served in the wars, in
as drivers, right?
I'm trying to remember what you'd call it. Anyway, dispensaries. Mm-hmm. They actually knew about poisons and medicine because that was their war work. Mm-hmm. And carried over. But now it's more like the ninja thing, and you know, blades and guns, and you don't see that many poisonings anymore because it's too easy to detect them.
I did love Deanna Rayburn's book, The Killers of
a Certain. Wasn't that great?
Oh my gosh, I love that book.
But see, that's another thing that's happening is now we're not just seeing women, empowered women with rage and all, but we're now getting the elder sleuth movement.
Yes.
I think Richard Osman's
series.
I'm looking across the room at, you know, these zillions of ARCs. There are 132 hardcover crime novels publishing in June. So I feel as though I'm actually defeated anymore by the volume of it. But I would say that there are probably a dozen elder sleuth books in that mix, which I would never. Do you remember Dorothy Gilman and Mrs. Pollifex, Naomi?
Yes. And don't forget my own Maserai.
Yes, Maserai. Exactly.
She's talking about women, but you're right.
You pioneered this.
Well,
I love the Maserai books. I thought they were wonderful, but I was thinking specifically about, you know, about women who not only were old but lacked agency, you know. So and they were easily overlooked. I don't know that elderly men are you know, kind of invisible. Maybe they are. Yeah.
Well, it depends on their profession. I think if you're an old Japanese gardener on the side of the road, you could be. But so what's next, Michelle?
Well, so I'm almost done with the sequel.
There is a sequel.
There's everyone's, that the whole gang gets back together 6 months after the events of this book, back in Vegas.
Back in
Vegas, baby.
Wow, so you really were influenced by Deanna Rayburn.
It's funny because there was a point where I had a different ending, and I realized after I wrote it that it would not enable me to continue with these characters in the same way, and so I went back and I changed it because I love this world and I love these characters and I wanted to give them a chance to have more fun together. So,
you wanted to keep the door open.
I wanted to keep that door open. You know, I feel like the adventure continues.
So I'm assuming writing the sequel was much easier than writing this.
Writing the sequel was so hard. I felt like, I knew the characters and I knew the world pretty well, but I felt a real need to at least match, if not top, this book. And I felt like that was a lot of pressure, you know. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I was also doing all of this other stuff. So I would love it. You know, sometimes, you know, I'm sure you've had, like, it's for me, writing is either like I sit down and I'm just a conduit and it's pouring out of me, but that's rare. It's much more often where I'm just pushing the rock up the hill, right? And then it's rolling over me as it goes back down. And this book was a lot of pushing that rock.
So do you know when it might be published, or are we?
Yeah, I think it's late May, early June next year.
Oh my gosh. That's great, Michelle.
Yeah, we'll see.
I'm going to ask Naomi now, because this too is a sequel. This book, Evergreen, Balasapan, Clark and Division, and you are taking Akihito and her family, who apparently are leaving Chicago and returning to California. But tell us a little bit about this, because Clark and Division, you know, I grew up in Chicago, and I was born in 1940, so I really wasn't old enough to, you know anything about what you wrote about. I mean, that kind of community. I didn't grow up in Chicago. I grew up in a suburb, so, you know, I completely missed it. But what inspired you to continue with the same characters and bring them back to California?
Well, I in the back of my mind, I did want it. They're like bookends. So even though it's called like the Japantown Mysteries, the way I'm planning to continue the series is actually I'm going to jump around in different time periods. Mm-hmm. Like the one after Evergreen will be in 1903.
Ooh,
So, cool. You know, just kind of play around with it. But these two books will be the Aki books. And I just thought the two bookends, she's in Chicago and then she's back home. And there's things that are going to be in going on in her personal life. She's newly married to a person she really doesn't know that well. So that's going to be kind of key in addition to just adjusting to life. You know, back in Los Angeles, she doesn't live in the same neighborhood. She lives in a place called Boyle Heights, which is kind of like the gateway. Michelle, you're familiar.
Yeah, I know. You know,
the gateway to like Southern California for a lot of immigrants and other people who are displaced. And Little Tokyo, you know, when it was emptied out, Blacks from the Deep South who came to California to work in the defense industry, they didn't have a place to live because of our racial covenants. So they go, the city said, hey, why don't, there's this very empty area near City Hall. Why don't you all live there? So they formed, there's like jazz clubs and things. So the book is also talking about that transition of people as well. And I know, Barbara, you have some ties, you know, to soldiers in Vietnam. Veterans, right? So that's a part of the story too. It's like post-traumatic stress that actually here World War II veterans, and my late father-in-law, he fought for the they call it the 100th 442nd Regimental Combat, you know, it's the all Japanese American unit that fought in Europe, and my late father-in-law was one of them. So
was he in France? And there's, you know, your friend James R. Benn, your fellow author,
yes,
in Soho, wrote one of his brilliant World War II mysteries about the, you say, the Japanese regiment that fought in Eastern France. And, you know, it's so weird when your life turns into history. I mean, you know, I mean, too. So my life is more history than your life. But, you know, I'm also astonished at how much I learned reading about my life that I didn't realize was going on in my life.
For sure. Yeah.
It's fascinating. Laurie King's last book, you know, Back to the Garden. I was horrified to realize that 1970 has now become historical fiction. Mm-hmm. If you sort of go with the 50-year, because when I opened the store in 1989, the 1920s were historical fiction. And that was kind of the boundary, you know, anything later than the 20s was kind of more contemporary. And now I realize that the 70s have really become historical compared to today. And, you know, that timeline moving forward is really unnerving.
Well, like Michelle, working with young people, the kids, you know, they weren't born until like 2000 something, right?
Let me just say, I'm in class with professors who are younger than me, so.
But they don't something. Know life, you know, they don't know life before the internet. They don't know life before, you know, cell phones. They don't know, I mean, even the vocabularies are completely, you know, different. I just read, I'm trying to think, a book, and it's all about influencers, which is not a word, you know, that any of us would particularly have recognized. And it's now a career. I mean, we just had an offsite book selling thing with a group here in Scottsdale And when I got there, I asked the people at the Camelback Inn, I said, you know, what is this group? Because the books were kind of oddly all over the place that we were asked to bring. And she said, oh, it's a group of influencers. Mm. And then she looked at me and she said, what is that? No, I wasn't really sure. But anyway, Naomi, may we ship you books to sign, or do you want to come and see us, or do you want to?
I want to come and see you guys.
Okay. But August is becoming kind of fraught, so why don't I email you tomorrow and we'll figure that out, because we'd love to have you here. That would be great. And Michelle, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you and get to know you. Naomi's right, I did miss your first books, or if I read them, all these years later, it's kind of hard for me to remember. But I'm delighted that you're doing a sequel to this. Are you going to look at all at the, you know, Las Vegas in my lifetime has become like a gourmet capital. I mean, there's the old Las Vegas, but there is a very, you know, high fashion, high power gourmet restaurant, fancy car part. Are you just going to leave that part of Vegas aside?
We're going to definitely, there's more of that version of Vegas in the new book. The sequel is definitely, you know, I know I don't want to give too much away, but our characters will have more access to that world now than, you know, where it would have been cost prohibitive before. So yeah, there will be some more glitz, but there will also be so many more motels.
Yeah, don't give that up. Don't give that up.
So many motels.
Yeah. So Jacob, come and join us and see if there are any questions or comments from the audience or anything you want to bring up. This is where he comes from behind the screen. I love this part of Zoom.
It's like the Wizard of Oz.
It is.
Yeah, so we have a few questions, but lots of really nice comments.
Nice.
I'm really excited for the book. This one's from Mia. Are you allowed to share the working title of the sequel?
I am 90% sure it's going to be Slaying You. So we have Killing Me and Slaying You, and then I'm going to have to get my thesaurus for the next book.
It's got to be us.
Yeah, exactly.
Susan says, who are your favorite writers, living or dead?
Well, I mean, I love Naomi's work, obviously. I love everything that Dennis Lehane has ever written. I love Margaret Atwood, Hannah French, Kate Atkinson. I think they're all amazing. I mean, it's always really hard for me because I just, you know, I'm a pretty voracious reader. I always have two or three books going at any given time. And I have so many wonderful friends that I've met because the mystery community is so warm and welcoming and rich. And so it's, I mean, those are the ones right off the top of my head.
Do you have an author that inspired you to write?
Probably Madeline L'Engle, honestly. Like, I feel like, you know, especially like reading it was the first book I think I read where a girl was the protagonist, you know, was really kind of the person who saves the world. And I remember reading it probably when I was right around the end, it was probably 11 or 12, and it really struck a chord with me.
I've met her. I know she's passed, but it's really wonderful.
Amazing. Yeah. Super jealous.
Naomi, how would you answer that question?
Oh, please, Barbara, we'll save it to when we see each other.
You have time to bone up, right?
Yeah.
She's taking notes.
I have the same problem when I go down to the store, you know, and a customer will rush up and I'll go, what's the best new book you've got? Or tell me, you know, and because I'm working so far ahead, my head is like in August, and so it's really, I can hardly ever answer that question when you're put on the spot like that. You really do need to think about it.
Well, and some of it is, there's some books that made a big impact on me, but they weren't necessarily maybe the best written books, but it was just the book I needed at the time, which, you know, so anyway, yes, go on if there's any more questions.
I think that's it for questions, but lots of comments, a lot of people excited to read the book.
Great. That's wonderful to hear.
Well, Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I'm excited to have done this with you, Michelle, and I'm really looking forward to seeing Naomi and Evergreen, and that'll be wonderful. So stay tuned for August, and we'll let you know when that might occur. So thanks very much for joining us, everyone. And we do still have, for those of you who are truly excited, autograph copies still of Kill Me. So feel free to order one. So good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. This was great.
Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.